All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. Really good to be back talking with you again this week. And I'm going to jump right into what we got lined up for you because it's a killer show and we don't have a whole lot of time to spare. At the back end of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a speech that Bob Avakian gave back in the late fall of 2012. And the speech is called Revolution, Nothing Less. And this section of the speech is very, very relevant to all the stuff that's been going on around the trial of the murderer of Jordan Davis and the way that Jordan's murder was just completely whitewashed and what that says about the lives of black people under this system, especially black youth. So that's the back end of the show. In the middle of the show, we're going to be talking with Carl Dix about the same subject, digging into what is it that happened with the murder of Jordan Davis? What is it that happened with the whitewashed verdict? And why couldn't the jury find a really obvious racist white murderer? Why couldn't they find him guilty? So stay tuned to find out about that one. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show. And I don't think he even remembers that he was on the show a number of years ago. But to welcome back to the show, Dr. Stephen Miles. Dr. Stephen Miles is the author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. And he's also a practicing physician who has been widely published on the topic of medical ethics and the ethics of torture. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be back. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, I have to tell you, you know, this subject, it never ceases to amaze me how deep and troubling this subject is. And, you know, especially when I was thinking about it, I was thinking about a lot of the things that I had read in preparation for this, including things that you've written. There's been a constant, there's always a reference to, and it seems like sort of logical, there's been a there's been a long history of the involvement of medical personnel or people involved in some form of medicine in torture across the centuries. But since the middle of the last century, there's also been a fairly developed and clear set of documents setting out moral and legal standards against medical involvement in torture. So how extensive is the problem today, and why have these documents been so seemingly so easily brushed aside?
Well, it's one of those glass half full, half empty things. You know, on the one hand, we never had codes before the end of World War II saying that docs shouldn't torture. And since then, we've had developing codes. But the thing that's really interesting is starting in 1975, at the same time we started holding government leaders accountable for torture, like in Greece and Portugal and Chile and so forth, we've had an accelerating rate of holding docs accountable for torture. And currently, since 75, about 80 of them have been punished, three more in the last 3 months. And I think we're seeing finally a major turning point in shifting from impunity to accountability.
So, but it's now, as you say that, there is still a question of this, you know, this involvement, and we'll get into it a little bit later. But is it still an extensive problem?
Absolutely. In fact, I can personally document 80 countries where I can prove that docs are participating in torture or have participated in torture since 1975 without any punishment. And in fact, it's easily true that there are more docs today who are assisting torture than are treating torture survivors.
Wow, that's a very heavy statement. You know, and one of the things I was thinking about when you were saying this is that, you know, there is this point that you know, you sent me a little link yesterday to a report that just came out. And as you said, you pointed out that it was a part of the report was on the involvement of British medical personnel in torture. And you said that this actually showed just scores of doctors who had been involved in torture.
Yeah, in the British case, this recent report came out and showed that about 58 docs were not properly handling torture prisoners in Iraq. Of course, Britain has a long history of torture that goes back, they had an extensive history of medically supervised torture in the colonies like Kenya, for example, and also in Cyprus. And then there was also torture involved in the war in Northern Ireland. And so this is a continuation. Now, on the positive side, Great Britain just removed for life the license of a doc who supervised torture in Afghanistan, and they suspended the license of another British doc. So we're seeing a shift there, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you've mentioned, you've said that the involvement of medical personnel in torture today is that it's not just an involvement, it's not just sort of a sideline thing, or it's not just a something that's sort of, and oh yeah, this is happening too. But you've said that the involvement of medical personnel is actually essential for torture today. Can you explain that?
Yeah, the docs actually are, they're totally built into the system in several ways. First off, they supervise prisoners to make sure that the ones who aren't supposed to die don't die, okay? And so in that sense, they will run the torture, help the prison system run the torture up and down in intensity so that the prisoner doesn't die. The second thing that they do is they devise methods of torture that don't leave scars that can be used as evidence against the government that administers the torture. Waterboarding is a good example. Psychological torture, how to adjust psychological torture. The third thing they do is they falsify either medical records or death certificates to conceal the fact that torture has occurred. The fourth thing they do is that when they get torture prisoners, they don't report the fact that the torture has occurred. And they do have options for doing this. If they can't do it through their own government, which many times they can't, they could inform local human rights organizations. The docs are passive, and they don't do it, and they're not at risk in many cases. For example, the U.S. docs were never at risk had they chosen to report torture in the War on Terror, but they just chose not to report it.
Mm.
So silence is one. Direct design of torture is another. Concealing torture is another.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Now, when you say that, when you talk about the docs, are we talking about military personnel who happen to be doctors, or are we talking about doctors in general?
Well, actually, some of these are military docs, some of these are police docs, some of them are prison docs, some of them are on contract. That is, the police will have a contract with the local hospital. For example, in Guyana, they had a contract with the local hospital to supply a doc. He came out, saw a kid who had essentially lighter fluid poured on his genitals and lit up, and then the doc came out, put some antibiotic paste on the kid and walked away without making a medical record or reporting it. And then some of these docs are like private docs, and the army will go too far. They'll bring a corpse, or they'll bring a badly injured patient to a hospital, and the docs will either treat or they'll turn the person away because they don't want to get involved.
Mm. You know, that brings me to this question, which is one that you started with in a lot of the things that you've in your presentations and things that you've written. You said that when you looked at the pictures from Abu Ghraib, that you actually looked and you wondered, okay, where are the medical personnel? And you were wondering where they were at. How did you answer that? And then what happened then? Where did you go from there?
Well, what I expected when I saw the Abu Ghraib pictures, the question was, why didn't the docs blow the whistle on it? And the ACLU was downloading Freedom of Information Act documents. They finally downloaded somewhere, I think, around 130,000 pages of documents. And I went through the medical documents and indexed them. That was about 60,000 pages. Put them up on a gigantic website, which has now been used 1.5 million times. And basically found, to my surprise, that I was looking for how the military had suppressed the docs' protest, and what I instead found was that the military had totally built the doctors into the abuse of prisoners and that they'd gone along with it, which was a surprising finding, and then I wrote all that up, of course.
Well, let me ask you about this. One of the things that I was actually, it's interesting. I know there's been a lot of struggle around this in society generally, and particularly within the profession, and that has to do with psychologists, which actually seems to be, you know, there's the one thing of the sort of the, you know, you have this vision of these, you know, doctors gone mad kind of thing that, you know, that are like medical doctors and other specialties. Then you have psychologists, and there's something that seems very, very, I don't know, it's a really intense area of work in terms of you're fooling around with people's brain, people's behavior. And there's been a particular development where the American Psychological Association is the only medical organization that doesn't have a position against the involvement of their people in these interrogations and what essentially amounts to involvement in torture. Why is that? Why do you think that is?
Well, when the U.S. government, the War on Terror, wanted to get into the harsh interrogation business, they wanted a method that didn't leave scars, and so they opted to go with psychological torture. And they didn't want to get the psychologists in trouble for doing this, so they had the American Psychological Association set up a committee to write guidelines, and then they gave something like 70% of the votes to the Defense Department officials who were designing the course of interrogations. And so what the American Psychological Association did then was it wrote a policy that was perfectly dovetailed to what the Defense Department wanted to do. Now, the really bizarre thing here is that the United States, like most Western governments, have studied a course of interrogations essentially since the end of World War II, and has produced a series of studies which show that it doesn't work. You get bad information, not good information. And then, in fact, negotiated rapport building actually gets your best information under all interrogation scenarios. But the psychologists working for the Defense Department decided to ignore all the scientific research and go along with these abusive interrogations. In fact, it got so bad at one point that the FBI, which does interrogations right, they focus on negotiation and rapport building, after protesting to the Army, finally challenged the Army to a duel. And they took a prisoner, and the FBI interviewed this guy and said, look, he doesn't have any intelligence information. He's just a driver. And the guys down at Guantanamo said, you guys are just mollycoddling these people. You just want to give them a hug. We're going to do it our way. And then they went off, and they worked the guy over for a while. And then they came back to the same intelligence briefing, and they said, you're right, he's just a driver. But we're going to keep using our method anyway. And at that point, the FBI pulled out of all the Army interrogations that were going off the rail.
Boy.
It was bizarre. Yeah. That is my favorite set of emails.
Oh, good. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a faculty member of its Center for Bioethics. Now, Steve, one question that comes up. In the latest edition of your book, you actually do dig into how interrogation psychologists may have moved from information gathering to coercive experimentation. And you've called this a troubling new direction in U.S. policy and military medicine, as well as an outside-of-the-park violation of the Nuremberg Code on research ethics. Can you talk about that a little?
Yeah, I mean, part of it, there's this amazing thing that's called the Catani log, and basically it's this weird minute-by-minute log of an interrogation that goes on over weeks and weeks. And it's fascinating that the structure of this log actually matches a older CIA protocol for how one does interrogations. And it appears that what they're doing is they're rotating coercive techniques and then assessing intelligence production as they rotate the interrogation techniques. That is, they'll belittle the person, then they'll see what they say, then they will adjust the fear up and see what they say, and then they'll offer them reassurance and see what they say, and then they'll say, your friends betrayed you, and then they'll see what they say. And it looks exactly like an experiment log. And the abusive research of prisoners was exactly the focus of what we condemned at Nuremberg. And we signed a series of protocols saying you can't do this. This guy actually got seriously medically ill during his interrogation. He suffered hypothermia, which required hospitalization. It was a nightmare hospitalization. And interestingly enough, even though he was seen by at least a dozen medical professionals, and even though the interrogation was designed by a psychologist, It was a civilian, or it was a naval official who blew the whistle on it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Dr. Stephen Miles, author of Oath Betrayed, Torture, Medical Complicity in the War on Terror. He's also a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School. Let me ask you this, and we're coming up on our next to the last question, ethical and moral questions. You know, and it seems to me that there's a huge question here. You know, and some people that are involved in some of the medical personnel that are involved in the in participating in interrogation and torture will always cite that there's a bigger need, there's a greater good that's being served. The ticking time bomb is the least of the things, but then it goes on from that in that direction. But it seems that there's also a much bigger impact in society at large. There's something that really, an impact on the entire society and each and every one of us in it who allow this, who tolerate this going on. Can you talk about that ethical and moral question?
Sure. First off, the ticking time bomb, I'm just going to say flat out, has been proven wrong. It's an incorrect assumption. It's been tested. It doesn't work. With regard to the larger effect, in order to have torture in your prisons, you have to essentially create a torturing society. That is, what you have to do to create a torture society is you have to define some group as radically other, okay? Jews, homosexuals, blacks, Al-Qaeda, you pick it. And then what you do is you move them outside of the normal framework of law. And then you build special institutions to hold them. And then you suspend the normal forms of legal accountability in those institutions. And then torture happens. And in order to build that kind of institution, you have to have the cooperation of the legislature and the press. You have to have dramas like the TV show 24 to carry the ticking time bomb hypothesis, and we all have to become participants in it. But the problem is that once you do that, you create a society that can be used against its own members, like the guy like Corporal Manning, or which constructs surveillance against its own members, like the Snowden leaks have shown us. And so the problem is that torture leads itself to the kind of state which endangers all of our liberties.
All right, Stephen Miles, one last question. I know it's not one that you can answer easily, but one question I wanted to ask you. Opposition from medical personnel, opposition from doctors. And I mentioned earlier in the show about this study that came out in last fall, Ethics Abandoned, Medical Professionalism and Detainee Abuse in the War on Terror, seemed to attract a lot of doctors who were standing up and saying, we're not going to be part of this. What does it look like in terms of opposition building?
I'm a hopeful guy. We're seeing more and more boards taking this on. I just got a call this morning from another country where they want to take on a doc who did virginity exams against Arab Spring uprisings. We're seeing a movement that is increasing steadily.
All right, Stephen. Thank you very much, man. Really appreciate it. And look forward to talking to you again soon, man. All right?
Please do.
Okay, take care now.
Bye.
Bye now. All right, you've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have just been talking with Dr. Stephen Miles. And Stephen is a professor of medicine at the University of Minnesota Medical School and a member of its Center for Bioethics. He's also the author of Oath Betrayed, America's Torture Doctors, and he is an expert on the question of medical complicity with torturers. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we'll be talking with Carl about the racist murder of Jordan Davis down in Florida back in 2012, the end of 2012, November of 2012, and the trial of his murderer, which just concluded with the murderer basically not being convicted of murder. All right, so stay tuned for that.
The dark brown shades of my skin only add color to my tears. Oh, oh, that splash against my hollow bones, that rocks my soul. Oh, 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 oh. Looking back over my first trip, wondering why my dreams never came true. Is it because I'm black?
All right, welcome back. That was Is It Because I'm Black from Syl Johnson. You know, back in November of 2012, a young black man, a black youth named Jordan Davis, was gunned down by a racist murderer. He was killed, you know, in the parking lot of a gas station, basically, because he was playing music, rap music, that this racist white Yahoo did not like. And so he took it upon himself to shoot 10 shots into the car and ended up killing Jordan Davis. And just recently, this racist murderer was, the jury was unable to basically come to a decision to convict him of murder. Instead, they convicted him of some other charges, but not murder. Joining us now to talk about this is Carl Dix. And Carl's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And he's a frequent guest on the show. And he's currently in Jacksonville, Florida. And Carl, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me on, Michael.
Well, you heard my introduction, and I know you've written about and spoken about this whole situation. Can you give people a sort of deeper understanding of what, just a picture they might have, of what actually happened? What happened in November of 2012 when Jordan Davis was cut down?
Yeah, I mean, what happened in November of 2012 was that some black youth were playing their music in a gas station parking lot. And Michael Dunn, the murderer, tells his fiance riding in the car about this rap crap. He complains to the youth that they should turn their music down. They don't do it. And he pulls out a gun and fires 10 shots into their car, including continuing to shoot at their car as they were pulling out of the gas station and driving away. These 10 shots murder Jordan Davis. Three of them hit him. They cut him down, and he dies on the spot. Then Dunn collects up his fiance, drives to his hotel so that his dog, who's at the hotel, could go potty, orders a pizza for dinner, finds out on the news that night that he's killed someone. Then he drives, goes to sleep, wakes up the next morning, drives about 200 more miles to his home, where he then contacts police after finding out they're looking for him for this killing. So this is what goes down: unprovoked murder, fleeing the scene of the murder, and then getting put into custody afterwards. And while he's held in jail waiting for trial, he's writing letters and making phone calls, talking about black people as thugs and how white people need to start killing some of them to get these black people to change their behavior. Then he comes into court, and all of a sudden he has decided that he saw a shotgun in the youth's car, a shotgun that nobody else saw and that he told no one about in the days after he murdered Jordan. And he talks about himself as a mild-mannered, peaceable person who's never had any racial hatred and never displayed racial hatred at any point in his life. The prosecutors do not bring in the evidence of the raw racist statements that he had in his letters and in his phone calls from jail, even though they had them. And essentially, this was a guy on the stand who teared up when he thought about his dog in the hotel room, who was having to hold his bladder until he got back to let him go potty, but showed no emotion when he discussed how he fired shots into Jordan Davis, ending his life, and fired shots at the black youth as they fled for their lives. No emotion whatsoever. I kind of watched him testify and said, this is kind of a call to all of you white supremacists out there who feel threatened by the fact that black people are no longer in their places. Come on, we've all been there. Stand with me, back me up in this. And he found a couple of white supremacists on the jury who would not convict him for murder. Mm-hmm. And what this comes down to is, this is America saying once again that black people have no rights that white people are bound to respect, that black life is worthless, and that the way in which the police have been approaching black and Latino youth as permanent suspects, guilty until proven innocent, if they can survive to prove their innocence, is now being re-extended to any white racist out there. And I'm thinking, Okay. Earlier in 2012, Trayvon Martin gets murdered by George Zimmerman. He doesn't get convicted for having murdered this young man. Then I go back 50 years or so, 60 years or so. Emmett Till, murdered by two white men who get brought to a trial and are also let go free. So it's really saying to us that this is what we're up against. The lives of black people and black youth in particular have no value in this society. And this really demands a response. This is not something that we can accept as just the way that things are. That's why we mobilized to act on the February 26th, 2 years since the murder of Trayvon Martin, but also why the Stop Mass Incarceration Network has put out a call to make this not the end, but a platform to advance and to continue the fight. Because this criminalization of black and Latino youth, it is horrific. It has led to the loss of lives of hundreds of black and Latino youth, and it is unacceptable, and it must be stopped, and it is up to us to stop it.
We're talking with Carl Dix, and he's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the racist murder of Jordan Davis and the recent whitewashing of that murder by not finding his killer guilty of murder. Carl, a lot of people might say to you, look, what do you want? Okay, it wasn't the best thing, but you have to give it. There was a trial. There were prosecutors who fought to get this, and they did, after all, get him convicted on, yes, lesser charges, but charges that could still mean life in prison.
I've heard that a bit. And see, here's the thing. By saying, well, the best that we could do is convicting him on these lesser charges, but we cannot convict him. And in fact, the court system refused to convict him for murdering Jordan Davis. It does come down to what is the value of black life. And then you have to layer that on top of the Trayvon Martin case, where again, we were told that this young black man who was stalked and confronted by George Zimmerman and shot to death, well, he threatened Zimmerman's life because maybe he did this or that. And they're saying to you that any racist can murder a black youth and beat that charge by claiming fear for their life and self-defense. And that is a statement that, one, America has made all too often. I went back to Emmett Till. I could have talked about a lot of the times that police killed black youth, Latino youth, and came through with the same thing. Well, I felt threatened. I thought they had a weapon. I thought they had a gun. They made a suspicious move. And we just have to say, no, this must stop. This can't go on. And it's got to be a thing where the people who are suffering from it, it's got to not just be the youth saying they want it to stop. It's got to not just be their parents saying this has got to stop. It's got to be everybody. Even people who are very clear that this will not happen to them need to confront the reality of this and then say, are they going to stand by and let this go down and be silent about it because they don't think it will happen to them?
Now, you know, one of the things I found very revealing, too, is that you look at, like, what's going on there, and you can see something very different happening here. Like the prosecutors, and it reminded me of Bob Avakian's statement about how the prosecutors in cases like this oftentimes, somehow they forget how to prosecute. Now, those same prosecutors involved in this case were also involved in the prosecution of George Zimmerman, the vigilante who murdered Trayvon Martin, which had a similar outcome.
Yeah, and see, that's an important point to bring in because these prosecutors who routinely send poor people, and most of them black or Latino, into prison, when it's a question of trying to deal with a cop who's brutalized or murdered somebody, or a racist who has murdered a black or Latino youth, they seem to forget what to do. Because a key part of Michael Dunn's defense was that, well, look, I'm a mild-mannered, peaceable guy who has never shown any racial animus. The prosecution had all of these phone calls and letters that he had sent from jail that made real clear that he was a racist, white supremacist dude. This is where the dude was coming from. And they let his lawyer bring out all of this stuff about, you know, he never showed any racial hatred towards black people. I'm peaceable. I'm mild-mannered. He needed to have been confronted with Did you issue these statements? Did you make these calls? So that the jury and the public at large is getting a sense of who was this guy who decided that these youth were playing thug music and that when they wouldn't turn it down, he had the right to pull out his pistol and start shooting at them. And what that had to do with the fact that they were young black people who he felt were getting out of their place.
And the whole thing here, where you're talking about, look, not just who he felt, you know, the thing about he felt they were getting out of their place, but it's also, and everything that's unfolded around this, it really is clear the point you were making earlier that, look, this is a statement on the system saying black youth don't have any humanity. They don't have any rights that people have to respect, but they've been dehumanized, criminalized and dehumanized. Let's talk about that a little bit. And then what the hell people can do about it. This has got to stop. This is way too, you know, you're seeing it time after time. Some point, people need to say, no, it stops here. We're talking with Carl Dix, and he's from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and we're talking about the racist murder of Jordan Davis and the recent whitewashing of that murder by not finding his killer guilty of murder. But let's talk about this criminalization, dehumanization, and then what are we going to do? Where's it come from, and what are we going to do?
Yeah, see, we really have to grab a hold of this criminalization and grapple with why we're up against it, because what we get from the authorities is that, well, black people have this trouble with the police, blacks and Latinos are overrepresented in prison. Well, that's because of their behavior. They commit more crimes. They're not taking personal responsibility for their lives. They're making poor choices with their lives. And that's not it at all. What it is that whole generations of black youth and increasingly broad sections of Latino youth are growing up in a system that has no future for them. The manufacturing jobs that used to be what would employ some of these people have been shipped halfway around the world where they can exploit someone more viciously than they could people in this country. That means that those youth can't be profitably exploited by this capitalist system, but they are here. And the authorities remember that in the 1960s, black youth were on the forefront of sparking the development of a radical and revolutionary movement that knocked the system back on its heels. They don't want to see that happen again, and their approach to that has been to flood the ghettos and barrios with police, to target the war on drugs at these youth, and to criminalize them and warehouse them in prison. And then when people get out of prison, to deny them basic rights, discriminate against them in employment, in housing, not even to let them vote. So you've got people who are caught up in the web of the criminal injustice system of this country. That's where the criminalization fits in, and that's where it's coming from. And see, what this points to is that this is something that cannot be reformed away. And this is important for people to get, especially right now, because you have the Attorney General, Eric Holder, talking about what a problem mass incarceration is and we've got to do something about it. You have Obama commuting the sentences of 8 people who were spending their lives in prison for simple possession of a banned substance. Well, there's thousands of people who are in prison just for simple possession. Letting 8 of them out is like tweaking things a little bit. Holder talks about we should do something about mass incarceration, but when thousands of people who are held in prison for simple possession and whose sentences would have been over under the new, as they reduced the disparity between crack and powder cocaine from 100 to 1 to 18 to 1, their sentences would have been over had they been sentenced under the new guidelines. Eric Holder's Justice Department went into court to block their release. In other words, I'll talk about too many people are in prison and something should be done about it, but I will also make sure they keep their behinds in prison. I will see to it that they don't get out, because the system actually has no future for these people. There's nothing that they could do with them, and they need to control them through the criminal injustice system. And this brings me back around to where I started, that this is unacceptable and it must be stopped. And look, it's going to take revolution, nothing less, to stop it. That's what it comes down to, because this is built into the fabric of this capitalist imperialist system. That's what's driving it, the very way the system works, and the conscious policies by the rulers of this country. And We in the Revolutionary Communist Party are working on exactly that, building a movement for revolution. And there's the leadership for this movement, and Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And people need to engage his works and hear his voice, because it brings out to people that things don't have to be this way. At the same time, people need to stand up and resist. You know, young people who this is coming down on really don't need to take this anymore. They need to stand up. They need to be part of politically resisting it. Parents who worry in the morning when their kids leave whether they'll be able to make it back safely, or will they have an encounter with a cop or a racist and end up brutalized, arrested, or even killed, don't need to take it anymore. And people who are seeing this, waking up to this, having their eyes open to it, and are wondering, am I living in a society where how people live and even whether they live is going to be determined by the color of their skin, and want no parts of it? They have to be a part of this resistance too. That's why we are building this kind of resistance, and that's why the Stop Mass Incarceration Network, and in particular Cornel West and I, have issued a call for people to strategize on making a big leap in resistance over the course of the year, culminating in a month of resistance to mass incarceration in October. And I really encourage your listeners to go to two websites. One is revcom.us, that's revcom.us, where they can find out a lot about what's happening with the movement of resistance to mass incarceration and with the movement for revolution. And also go to the website stopmassincarceration.net. That's stopmassincarceration, all one word, no punctuation, .net, and get connected with the movement of resistance to mass incarceration.
All right, Carl, thank you very much. And we will be sure to have you back very soon, man, because I'm thinking, even as we're talking, we need to dig into this a lot deeper on a lot of different fronts. There's a lot of questions to explore here. Maybe get you back. We'll spend a whole hour talking about this whole point about the, you know, what's happening with the dehumanization, criminalization of the youth, and what's the solution to all this, and how do people take it? What are the expressions? What are the solutions?
Okay. So thanks for having me on this time, and I'll definitely be back on to get more into this. There's a lot more to get into.
All right, Carl. Thank you very much, man. Bye.
Bye.
All right. You've been listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we have just been talking with Carl Dix from the Revolutionary Communist Party and the Stop Mass Incarceration Network. And we've been talking about the racist murder of Jordan Davis down in Florida back in November, and the recent trial, and actually the recent trial that was not able to convict the man who pretty much said straight up, yeah, I shot him. What are you going to do about it? What was concentrated in that, what it says about the system, and what it says about the kind of society we got and the kind of society we need and how we need to get there. So we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian. And that speech is called Revolution, Nothing Less. And this excerpt focuses in large part on the situation that's facing black youth in this country. They're murdered by police, mass incarceration, they're murdered by racist murders, all of that. And it poses the question, now how long are we going to put up with this? So stay tuned.
Somebody tell me, what can I do? Oh, Lord. Oh, something is holding me back. Is it because I'm black? Yeah.
All right, welcome back. That was a little bit more from Syl Johnson's Is It Because I'm Black? All right, in this part of the show, we're going to be listening to an excerpt from a speech by Bob Avakian. The speech was given in the late fall of 2012, and it was titled Revolution, Nothing Less. And this excerpt has a lot to do with what we've just been talking about, the whole situation facing black people and black youth in particular these days. What's behind it? What do we do about it? What kind of society are we living in? What kind of society do we need, and how are we going to get there? So check this out.
Well, what we're doing here today is taking place, of course, in the context of the recent elections, about which we're all supposed to be very excited. I don't know how many of you watched the victory celebration at Obama headquarters the night of the election. I couldn't help feeling, as I was watching the people there waving their little American flags and bobbing their heads up and down to the music, that they reminded me of nothing so much as a bunch of bobbleheads on the dashboard of a car heading for a terrible wreck. And I thought to myself, who else could have gotten all these people there waving those flags, who else could have got them to applaud for a speech by Obama? Full of flag waving, patriotism, outright jingoism, America is the greatest country in the world. Full of militarism, celebrating the army of empire which marauds around the world, bombing and destroying and taking lives. Praising the Navy SEALs for carrying out their heroic assassinations. And ending with his crescendo to the tired old cliche that if you work hard, you can make it in America. The old lie that you can make it if you try. 4 more years was the chant. 4 more years of what? Of crimes? War crimes? Crimes against humanity? 4 more years of silence and complicity and even active apology and support for these crimes on the part of people who call themselves liberals and progressives? Well, I will have more to say about Obama and elections, particularly elections under this system, as we go along. But let's step back from this now and begin with the larger picture and the larger question of what kind of world we live in and why, and what kind of world is possible. If I were a preacher looking out at what goes on with the nightmare of oppression and brutality that so many in this world are forced to endure, day after day, generation after generation, I would cry out, "How long, O Lord?" Now, in case there's any confusion, I am not a preacher, and I'll have more to say about the Lord as we go along. But let's look at what this system does to people. Let's start with just one great crime of this system. Police murder after murder after murder of black people and Latinos, especially youth. Check it out. If you go on the internet and you search for police kill unarmed youth, you will scroll down and down and down and down for pages and pages and pages with the same pattern, the same ugly pattern repeating itself. And you will see that not only are these youth unarmed, but once again, overwhelmingly, they are black and Latino. And if you search a little deeper and a little further, you will see that almost never are the police punished or even prosecuted for these grotesque and wanton murders. And you will run into two of the most wounding words in the English language at this point: justifiable homicide, which the family and loved ones of those so wantonly killed are repeatedly slapped in the face with as the verdict on these murders. Let's just take a couple of the latest outrages. Manuel Diaz, murdered by the police in Anaheim, shot in the back, and then shot in the back of the head. While the next day, in the same city of Anaheim, another Latino youth, Joel Acevedo, was also shot down by the police. And here's an irony that came out in relation to the murder of Manuel Diaz. His mother said at one point Manuel was thinking about joining the army. Think about this. You can be a black or Latino youth out on the streets with no prospects and no future, only the possibility of getting yourself into trouble, running up against other youth just like you and maybe getting into it with them, or running up against the police. Or you can join the army of the same system that's put you on the street in that situation to reinforce with brute force the same system that has put you in that situation, and to go out into the world and be part of the mindless killing machine doing the same thing to people just like you all around the world. Or what about Oscar Grant, killed a couple of years ago in Northern California by the BART, the Rapid Transit Police? This was also caught on the cell phones of many people. They knocked him to the ground, straddled him while he was face down, and shot him to death. Captured on the cell phones, but it made no difference. Through the lengthy process they always go through, in this case because the people rose up, they had to prosecute. But once again, we run into the situation where, strangely, in these kind of situations, the prosecutors who vigorously prosecute with full animus when they're going after someone like Oscar Grant forget how to prosecute when it's the cops on trial. And the whole thing is set up so the cop gets off on a light charge, a minor sentence, and is back out. Think of the outrage of this and the insult on top of the outrage to the family and loved ones and to everyone who cares about justice. Or what about Romarley Graham in New York City, killed in his own house by the police? He's walking home in his neighborhood. He's a black youth, so the police assume he must be up to no good. He must be selling drugs. He looks furtive. He's making strange motions. What he's doing is taking out his keys and opening the door to his house. He walks into his own house. He's killed in his own house by the police in front of family and loved ones. And in response to this, his mother comes forward and says, "This has got to stop." And his father, almost as if in a trance, keeps repeating over and over again, "Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son? Why did they kill my son?" And they weren't done yet. The New York cops then came to the courtroom and applauded their fellow pig who murdered Romarley in cold blood, viciously taunting the family and loved ones of Romarley and demonstrating yet one more time the ugly truth that in the way this country has been built and for the powers that be in this country, the humanity of black people has never counted for anything. They have never been valued as human beings, but only as things to be exploited, oppressed, and repressed. How many more times does this have to happen? How many more times do the tears and the cries of anguish and anger have to pour forth from the wounded hearts of people? And if this is not enough, this system viciously exploits people twice, abusing and brutalizing them, and then taking the tortured beauty of their cries of agony and outrage and capitalizing on it, declaring it to be a great expression of the marvelous American culture and its diversity. Think about the blues, for example. There's a lot of stuff in blues that's about personal problems and some nonsense, including men wanting to dominate women. But to a large degree, the blues is about the experience and the suffering of black people in America. Notice it's called the blues, not la, 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 we're living the American dream. Or how about jazz? I'm thinking of when I moved to Chicago in the 1970s. I didn't have a car, and I had to take a cab. And I got in a cab that was driven by this hip young white guy. I don't mean these kind of phony hipsters they got around now. I mean a real hip young white guy. As we started talking, it turned out that he was a jazz musician, or a musician in general, and was just driving a cab to try to be able to keep going. He reminded me of a scene I saw in a Richard Pryor concert, where he got up and before he came on the stage, Patti LaBelle and her band had performed. And Richard Pryor said, "Did you see that white guy playing the saxophone up there? He was just like this, with every note. He didn't miss a note. He just like, 'Go ahead, brothers, I'm with you. I ain't missing it. Go ahead, I'm with you.'" And that's what this cab driver reminded me of. And after we talked a while, he said to me, "Are you into jazz?" And I said, "Well, not really that much. I've listened to some jazz, I like it, but I'm more sort of into rhythm and blues." He said, "You really got to get into jazz. If you listen seriously to jazz, if you listen to Coltrane, what you hear is all the long years of oppression and suffering of black people coming right out the end of his instrument." So I thought, well, I guess I'm going to have to get into jazz some more. But there was a deep truth there. Yes, there's love, as Coltrane put it, a love supreme. But there was also defiance and anger. Now, how many times does this have to keep going on? Now, once again, I'm not a preacher. And if people crying out, "How long, O Lord, could put things right," there should be no more need for people to keep on crying out in this way, and no more need for them to keep on praying. The Lord should have put things right a long time ago. And if the Lord really existed, we would have to ask, what is the matter with the boy that he let things go so wrong for so long in the first place? Now, the truth is, there is no Lord, and we do not need, nor should we want or accept, any lords and masters, imaginary ones or real ones, lording it over us. Some say this is all God's will. No, it is not. And it does great injury to those suffering so terribly and so unnecessarily in this world to tell them that this is God's will, or attest that this supposed God has set before them to endure horrible oppression in this world with the promise of a better life in some other world, some afterlife, which is not real and will never come. But ask yourself this: if there were a God or gods, why would it be the will of that God or gods that for so long, so many people have suffered so terribly with oppression, degradation, and brutality, while a much smaller number continue to accumulate wealth and exercise power and live lives of parasitic indulgence on the basis of exploiting and oppressing those masses of people all over the world? Why would that be the will of this God? And then let's go on and ask the next question that suggests itself. Whose interest does it serve for people to believe that all this is God's will? Now, I know there are people who feel inspired and sustained by their religious beliefs in the fight against injustice, including the unjust wars repeatedly waged by the American government. Some have spent their lives dedicated to acting on what they identify as prophetic traditions within religion, which they see as calling for standing with and standing up for the poor and oppressed and fighting against injustice. We respect and work to build unity with people holding and acting on those sentiments. In accordance with the communist principles and objectives on which our party is based, we recognize the great importance of reaching out and building unity broadly with people of many diverse viewpoints in the fight against the crimes of this system and the great suffering this causes. And these same principles and objectives also lead us to recognize the importance of boldly and forthrightly putting forward our communist viewpoint and of engaging in serious and principled discussion, and yes, struggle, with people coming from different worldviews in the spirit of seeking the truth and striving to bring forward and to act in the fullest way in accordance with the fundamental interests of the masses of people. It is in this spirit that I am putting forward the views of our party, straight up and full out. Communists are atheists. We do not believe in any gods or any kind of supernatural forces or beings. There is no evidence for the existence of a god or gods, or of any supernatural forces or beings. No evidence which is based in the real world and can be tested in this real world, which is the only existence there is. There is, however, plenty of evidence for the fact that human beings have invented gods and supernatural forces. Now let me say this. I am sick to death of the daily and continual horrors that life under this system means for the great majority of humanity. And I am sick to death of having to say how long, even if not, O Lord. And while I am a firm scientific atheist and do not believe in any gods, I can say, and I do say, God damn these mother. I say it again, no more generations of our youth, here and all around the world, whose life is over, whose fate has been sealed, who have been condemned to an early death or a life of misery and brutality, whom the system has destined for oppression and oblivion even before they are born. I say, no more of that.
All right, that was Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and that was an excerpt from a speech he gave back in the late fall of 2012, and the speech is called Revolution, Nothing Less. And if you want to find out more information about how you can pick up a copy of Revolution, Nothing Less, go to revcom.us, and you'll also be able to access Carl Dix's statements on this, and it's just a website that'll put you right in the middle of everything you need to know about the movement for revolution in this country and the fight to stop all this terrible horror and abuse. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And I want to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and all of you for tuning in. And I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show. And if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. Let's go out now with a little bit more from American Skin, 41 Shots.
41 shots, and we'll take that ride across the bloody river to the other side. 41 shots cut through the night. You're kneeling over his body in the vestibule, praying for his life. Is it a gun? Is it a knife? Is it a wallet? This is your life. It ain't no secret. No secret, my friend. You can get killed just for love.